In Greek, they have four words for love. Storge, S-T-O-R-G-E, means affection, the sort of love there ought to be between near relations. Philia, P-H-I-L-I-A, means friendship. Eros, E-R-O-S, is of course the love between the sexes. And agape, A-G-A-P-E, is love in the Christian sense, God's love for man and the Christian's love for the brethren. I want to talk about all four, and I'll begin with storge, or affection. Almost anyone, it seems, can be loved with storge. The ugly, the stupid, even the exasperating can be its objects. There need be no apparent fitness between those whom it unites. It ignores even the barriers between species. We see it not only between dog and man, but, more surprisingly, between dog and cat. What's common to all the objects of storge is that they are familiar. We can often identify the very day and hour when a friendship began or when we fell in love. But we never catch storge at the moment of its beginning. To become aware of it is to become aware that it's already been going on for some time. In our storge, we're rather like the dogs, who wag their tails at familiar people even if they've never done them any kindness, and bark at strangers even if they've never done them any harm. This apparently indiscriminate character in storge, and its dependence on familiarity, point to its animal and biological origins. Let me say at once, for this will often come across us in the following talks, that I don't mean the word animal to be derogatory. Nothing in man is either better or worse for being shared with the beasts. The distinction between what we share and what is specifically human is not a moral one. When we blame a man for behaving like a beast, we mean that he displays characteristics common to man and beast on occasions where those peculiar to man were demanded. What we call brutality in man, say in a Russian or German torturer, is usually behavior which the brutes in fact don't exhibit. My Greek lexicon defines storge as affection, especially of parents to offspring. And that, I've no doubt, is the original form of the thing, as well as the central meaning of the word. We understand the later, more remote ramifications of it, if we start with the right basic image. A mother nursing a baby, a bitch or a cat with a basket full of puppies or kittens, all in a squealing, nuzzling heap together, continuously moving, yet somehow at rest, a warm animal smell and all the noises. But while the original form of storge is thus seen in the nursery or the basket, it branches out in all directions. But however far storge travels from its source, it still retains from it a strong flavor. It's usually the humblest of the loves. It gives itself no airs. Storge is modest, even furtive and shamefaced. Storge has a very homely face, so have many of those for whom we feel it. It's no proof of your cleverness or perceptiveness or refinement that you love them, nor that they love you. To have to produce storge in public is like getting your household furniture out for a move. It was all right in its native place, but it looks tawdry out of doors. And the feeling of storge is so nearly organic, so gradual, so unemphatic, that you can no more pride yourself on it than on getting sleepy towards bedtime. It lives with humble, undressed, private things. The thump of a drowsy dog's tail on the kitchen floor. The sound of a sewing machine. Easy laughter and easy tears on some shrewd and wrinkled old face. A toy left on the lawn. It's the most comfortable and least ecstatic of loves. It is to our emotions what soft slippers and an easy, almost worn-out chair and old clothes are to our bodies. Wraps you round like a blanket, almost like sleep. At its best, gives you the pleasures, the ease and relaxation of solitude, without solitude itself. If we were talking about drinks, our section on gin would certainly have to note the fact that besides being a drink in its own right, gin is an excellent base or medium for several mixed drinks. Storge is similarly a base or medium for other loves. Being the oldest, most spontaneous form in which we go out of ourselves towards others, it is naturally taken up, both into friendship and into eros. One might say it clothes them. In the end, all those things about your friends, which had nothing to do with the friendship originally, become dear because they become familiar. As for eros, I can think of few things more distressing than to experience it for more than a very short time without storge. Every good marriage, even every courtship, makes for its eros, so to speak, a nest of storge, like the nest of rice you build for your helping of curry. This relation between eros and storge is well seen in the two outward expressions they have in common. One is the kiss. Which borrowed this from the other, I don't know. It's not enough to say that you kiss your child and you kiss the woman you love, but in very different ways. For kisses between lovers aren't always lovers' kisses. The truth is that Storge kisses in one way only, while Eros kisses both in Storge's way and in his own, expressing sometimes the most transporting passion, sometimes quiet affection, and often many intermediate states in between. The second expression in common is more embarrassing. Lovers as well as parents tend to indulge in baby language. This makes many modern people, me among them, uncomfortable. I've spoken of Storge so far mainly in terms of comfort and heart's ease, something that oils the wheels of life. But it has far higher values. It comes near to Agape's power of loving the unlovable. It certainly loves the unattractive. It doesn't do this quite in Agape's way. A mother, say, loves an intrinsically unlovable son because nature compels her, because in caring for him she fulfills a need of her own. Storge, without being Agape, imitates her actions. Then secondly, as we've seen, it's familiarity that qualifies people to be the object of Storge. And of course it's the circumstances of our lives, many of them accidental, grown up we hardly know how, that have made them familiar. We haven't chosen them. They can include men whom we should never have selected as friends, and women with whom we could never conceivably have fallen in love. Familiarity teaches us first to endure and then to enjoy humanity in forms most alien to us, as habit teaches us to like foods we didn't naturally like. Lovers and friends feel, it's not always a delusion, that they were made for one another. The glory of Storge is that it unites those who most emphatically, even comically, are not. The acquaintances we make for ourselves are, of course, chosen to suit our own tastes, people of our sort. The possible objects of Storge are just whoever happens to live under the same roof or meet you every day. You need a really Catholic taste to be able to get something out of any odd collection of books found in a hotel. You may need only a very narrow one to enjoy all the books in your own study. You chose them. When we thus come to love the unattractive, what was unattractive to us, we're often led on to a momentous and sobering discovery. We find in them, it may be, great humor, sense, or even goodness. Not goodness of some particular kind that happens to please our own palate. Just goodness. We shouldn't have noticed it if mere familiarity hadn't bred affection. It wouldn't have attracted us. We now see that it ought to have. We learn how very narrow our range of appreciations is, how little taste for goodness we have, except when it's dressed and served to suit our idiosyncrasy. But mellowed by Storge, we almost reach the stage of loving goodness itself. Now at this point we must be on our guard. For really, from everything that's been said, the resemblance between Agape and Storge is astonishing. Storge is not puffed up. It suffers long and is kind. It loves the unlovable. It also loves goodness, which is the essentially lovable. We might be tempted to identify the two, to say that what I've been calling Storge is not a special and wholly natural kind of love, but love itself, or goodness, the rightful sovereign of the world. Such identification seems implicit in much 19th century fiction. In Trollope and Thackeray, even at times in George Eliot, the conflict between good and evil is represented simply as a conflict between the domestic affections and, say, ambition or snobbery or gambling or whatnot. And when the hero is claimed or reclaimed by the domestic affections, we're apparently meant to feel that he's saved. Of course, no Christian could accept this idolatry of the domestic affections. Those authors write as if they'd never heard, never even felt the need of denying the text about hating wife and mother and one's own life also for Christ's sake. We've been better taught. We know that every natural impulse, however innocent in itself, may stand between God and us and so become an idol. But that's not the side of the thing I want to emphasize at the moment. These authors also take insufficient notice of some facts about Storge which are discernible without Christian instruction. They're a matter of common observation and bitter experience. I leave out of account for the moment its dangers as a possible rival to God. How often, how long, if left to her merely natural workings, does Storge succeed in realizing even the natural and this worldly good which she seems to promise? Storge, unless she submits to something higher than herself, does not remain Storge. This natural love carries in itself the seeds of natural hatreds. every one of its characteristics is ambivalent. Almost anyone, I've said, may be loved by Storky. Yes, and most of us expect to be. The egregious Mr. Pontifex, in Samuel Butler's Way of All Flesh, is shocked that his son doesn't love him. It's unnatural that a boy should not love his own father. He assumes that Storky is a sort of love laid on, or built in, by nature. It's ready-made. It's on the house. We need to do nothing to deserve it. Storky is often assumed as a right, and often the party who has done nothing lovable hungers to be loved, and continues to be not only disappointed, but shocked and outraged because he's not. And once this situation exists, it will continually worsen. If someone's already unlovable, a continual demand on his part to be loved as of right, his sense of injury, creating us a sense of guilt, guilt for a fault we couldn't have avoided, and can't by any effort of will cease to commit. For if in some favoured moment any germ of affection stirs in us, his demand for more and still more freezes us up again, and each becomes a torment to the other. I once knew a mother who incessantly complained of her adolescent daughter's lack of affection. What more could I do for her than I do, she asked. I live for her. And the pitiful fact is that this was, in a sense, true. She was no frivolous, neglectful, or self-indulgent mother. She worked hard for the girl, denied herself lots for her, was always making things for her, giving her presents, arranging treats. But it never occurred to her to consider whether all these things and presents and treats were those the girl wanted. Though often complaining that the daughter didn't confide in her, she never in any serious degree listened to anything the daughter said. The dawning interests of adolescence were swept aside with jokes. Needless to add, any effort made by the daughter to put her own point of view on a disputed matter was a total failure. If she put it at all trenchantly, she met reproaches and finally temper. If she put it gently, she was met by sobs and embraces and cuddlings and pet names. For the mother held the common belief that scenes, as they are very justly called, of affection, solve all problems and remove all tensions. In reality, of course, they usually leave things just where they were, unless, indeed, the debauch of emotion, like other debauches, leaves a hangover. Now, no small part of this mother's unlovableness consisted in downright bad manners. We're always hearing complaints about the rudeness of the rising generation, but though I'm nearly 60 myself, I'm far more often impressed with the rudeness of parents to their children. Who has not been the embarrassed guest at family dinners where one or other of the parents treated their grown-up offspring with an incivility which, practiced on any other young people, would have terminated the acquaintance? Ruthless interruption, flat contradiction, loud ridicule of things the children take seriously or even hold sacred, insulting references to their best friends, dogmatic assertions in matters about which the young are instructed and their elders ignorant, provide a ready answer to the old question, why are they always out? Why do they seem to prefer every house in the neighbourhood to their own? They prefer civility to barbarism. This barbarism, which renders not only conversation, but even real acquaintance impossible, grows very easily out of one element in Storky. I've compared it to old clothes and slippers, an undress affair. But this most delightful and important element can be revoltingly misinterpreted and abused. It is right to wear your old clothes at home, but not to wear the same underclothes till you smell. It's a sort of distinction some people don't seem to make. Because home is, or should be, a place where formality of manners isn't required, they think it's a place where no manners are required. Of course, the mistake is made only by people of a certain inner and essential grossness. Those who leave their good manners behind them when they come home from the party can have had no really good manners even there. But, of course, in such a mother as I'm speaking of, there's a far darker streak. The daughter is to have everything she can give, but if possible, nothing that anything or anyone else gives. This is important because it's not a departure from Storky. It's a congenital malady in Storky. Storky's born with the tendency to it. It's not a weakness which needs specially adverse conditions to bring it out. It will come out unless measures are taken to guard against it. And you see how it naturally arises from the very origins of Storky. The whole appeal of the baby or of the young is their total dependence on the mother. And, of course, it's not only mothers who respond to that. We all, in some measure, feel the appeal of the helpless. And if, in supplying their needs, we also gratify an emotional need of our own, there's no harm in that. A duty is none the worse for being also a pleasure.
Yes.
But, of course, as the creature ceases to be helpless, this particular pleasure will cease. All the activities involved in caring for a child, for instance, are directed to that end. We feed it and wash it and teach it to walk and talk in order that it may presently do all these things without our help. We are, or should be, labouring to make ourselves unnecessary. Does the knowledge, I am no longer necessary, strike like a knell? If so, we must, I believe, conclude that our storghe was not the sort of love that desires the good of its object. We have desired for it not good as such, but only that amount and kind of good which we could gratify our own need by giving. Those who cannot bear to become unnecessary have various ways of dealing with the situation. The least mischievous is to set up a substitute object, such as a spoiled dog. Much less desirable is the attempt to persuade yourself that you still are needed after all. This, of course, is done by inventing imaginary needs in the other parties. You can thus work your fingers to the bone doing things for your family. True, a moment's reflection, or even your family's repeated assertions, would tell you that most of these things were unnecessary, undesired, and a perfect nuisance to everybody. It's no use to tell the corresponding type of woman that she'd much better discontinue her works of supererogation. Because if she did, she would be faced with the very fact she's trying to avoid. So long as she keeps on, she can feel necessary. And she has also other gratifications. The laboriousness reassures her about the quality of her love, a subject on which she has repressed doubts. It whispers to her, as long as her back aches and her feet burn, how much I must love them if I do all this. But also, more terribly, the unappreciativeness of the others, the unforgettable wounding words, for any words will wound a person of that sort, in which they point out that the laundry really does the washing very much better and they can afford to send it out, or that they all actually prefer cold lunches, give her what seems just cause for her feeling of ill usage. Therefore, for the sweets of resentment, she is so obviously in the right and they in the wrong. But can resentment be sweet to those who love? It's perhaps a question of terminology. Certainly, ordinary usage allows us to describe as love many states which already contain a very substantial ingredient of hatred. It's, of course, a gross error to suppose that jealousy is specially associated with erotic love. Even in the injured wife or husband, the feeling has often quite as much to do with wounded storghe as with the infringement of sexual possession. Every sort of love wants the same mind. Unconverted or uncorrected storghe in her merely natural condition is jealous. This jealousy is by no means confined to parents. Two children, brother and sister, grow to a certain age sharing all their interests. Then a dreadful thing happens. An interest which one can't share enters the life of the other, say literature or serious music or botany. The one who's left behind feels it's a kind of treason. His jealousy of the new interest is usually expressed by ridicule. The thing's all silly nonsense anyway. The other's only pretending to like it, only showing off. This explains in part the seemingly almost fiendish rancor often displayed by a lowbrow family when one member of it shows signs of becoming intellectual, or of an unbelieving or worse still semi-believing family when one member becomes a Christian. I used to think that both these were due to a sort of disinterested hatred, the one for what is intellectually high, and the other for God himself, God who is in the long run the supreme object of all human jealousies. But perhaps it's not quite so bad as that. It's the reaction to desertion. One who is all ours has become in part a stranger, and above all, change has begun. The seemingly immemorial order has cracked. This is the beginning of the end, the first breath of winter. For storghe, whose very food is the familiar, dislikes alteration. Sometimes a curious double jealousy is felt. We're jealous of the new interest because it has stolen the heart we love. But it's possible at the very same moment to be jealous the other way round. Supposing for a moment there were, after all, anything in all this classical music or this religion, why in heaven's name should he or she see it when we don't? Why should they be selected for admission to it? Why not we? The mildest and safest line the older generation seized with such jealousy can take is to say, tolerantly, indulgently, it's a phase, it'll all blow over. This is a capital device, for it's very galling to the chit or whippersnapper you're talking at, and at the same time not very easy to resent. It even has the incidental advantage that you may believe it. Better still, it may even turn out to be true. And it won't be our fault if it doesn't. I was talking about storge, or affection, in its depraved form. I don't think we gain much by describing these nasty states of mind as neuroses. If the word means that they are, in a spiritual sense, diseased states, we knew that already. If it means they are literally diseased, so that we're no more responsible for them than for measles or some kind of insanity, we all know this to be untrue. Which of us for one single day can live with those he loves best and not feel the impulse to demand much and to give little, to love them rather as extensions of ourselves than as free souls for whom we and all things were made? These temptations, in fact, are on a par with all our others. You might as well call it a neurosis when I stay in bed too long in the morning, or snap back, or take more than my fair share of the strawberries. To be a self is ipso facto to be potentially selfish. If you're going to call all this neurosis, the real name of that neurosis is being a fallen man. The old word sin was often used. Again, neurosis might imply that we needn't repent nor labor to amend, but only have a treatment. Now, of course, it's true that in particular cases there is a real neurosis. There are causes outside the offender's consciousness which make impossible to him what is hard to all, or which at least make it harder for him to resist these temptations and make his behavior worse when he yields. On that peculiarity, therapeutics may work, but it's working on the peculiar aggravation of something which is both normal and detestable. The peculiarity may perhaps be cured, but the radical, the congenitally human selfishness behind it is not a question of cure in that sense. Medicine labors to preserve or restore natural structure or normal function. But greed and pride aren't unnatural or abnormal in the same sense as astigmatism or a floating kidney. For who in heaven's name could describe as normal or natural in the medical sense the soul from which they were totally absent? Natural in a quite different sense, if you like, arch-natural, seen only once since the fall. And certainly not at all like the psychologist's picture of the integrated, adjusted, balanced, happily married, satisfactorily employed, popular, regular citizen. You can't really be so well adjusted to your world, you know, if it ends by nailing you up to a stake of wood. But long before this, I expect, some listener wants to interrupt me with the protest, I thought you defined storge as a kind of love. All these horrors you've been describing are not love at all, they're unlove. And, of course, such a listener's perfectly right. One way of treating my subject would be to say that just as there is none good but God and nothing good but goodness, so there are no loves but love itself, the very love, and that what I call the other natural loves are not loves at all in their own right, but become so only insofar as they participate in the very love. Well, I welcome everyone who was thinking that before we began, and I shall have failed with everyone who isn't thinking it by the end. And after all, storge, even in its depraved condition, has many of the characteristics of what we call love in ordinary speech. It desires some good for its object. It feels pain when the object is absent, though not always pleasure when it's present, and anxiety when the object is in danger. And by a peculiar paradox, which would be comic if it weren't so very miserable, it may feel lasting sorrow on being bereaved of one with whom the mourner passed hardly a day unmarred by quarrels. For storge is great at laying flowers and graves and keeping anniversaries, sometimes far better at lamenting you when you're dead than being fair to you while you're alive. This is the reason, I think, why one often feels disgust at many of the sentimental songs about storge, like Home Sweet Home. They treat as holy something which is rarely capable of and in need of sanctification. The songs are, in a word, idolatrous. They make storge a goddess. Those who treat storge like a goddess are her enemies as well as ours. Well, that concludes what I have to say about storge, and now I change my subject and go over to my next theme, philia, or friendship.